which is a briefing on grazing. We're going to break for lunch at 12:30, so, or as close to 12:30 as possible, because some people have to get flights. So.
Okay, we'll get started. Again, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission, Director, Deputy Director, the opportunity to be here today and talk. My name is Paul Damer, the Land Stewardship and Operations Section Manager in the Lands Division, and with me here today is Jeff Burnham, who's our statewide range ecologist, and Jeff works with wildlife area managers in developing their grazing management plans and monitoring strategies around those plans, so he'll be talking about that in today's presentation. I'll be talking briefly about our grazing program review and giving you an update on that, and then Jeff will go into our current grazing practices and address the specific questions that you had asked for in this presentation. The department is conducting a programmatic review of its grazing policies and practices to ensure that the agency's grazing program on department lands is consistent with the agency's mission and strategic goals. Components of that review include looking at our current grazing WAC and grazing commission policy to evaluate them for consistency, clarity, and the relationship to our strategic plan. Another component of this review is looking at developing a grazing evaluation framework, which will allow us to consistently evaluate potential new grazing on our lands and think about potential benefits, potential risks, and costs. And then the final components of our grazing review is developing more comprehensive management plans and comprehensive and defendable monitoring and adaptive management strategies. And that's what Jeff is going to be talking to you about in just a minute here. The next steps regarding this review is taking these components, putting them together, and going through some internal outreach this spring and early summer. We have a cross-program team established already to look at these components. We'll also be going to our wildlife program senior staff to review any proposals, and then we'll take it out for external outreach in summer, early fall. We'll be contacting, inviting input from the Cattlemen's Association, the Soton County Lands Group, Kittitas County Lands Advisory Board, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, Nature Conservancy, Western Watershed Conservation Northwest, and others that want to participate. If we have proposed substantial changes, we will go through State Environmental Policy Act, which will be another opportunity for public input. And then our goal is to come to you at the end of the year with any proposed changes to our existing WAC and policy revisions associated with those. And now I'm going to turn it over to Jeff to talk about our current practices.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Commissioners, Director, Deputy Director. As Paul mentioned, I'll be talking today about administration of livestock grazing on department lands, with specific details about protective conditions contained within these permits, the type of monitoring that we conduct, outreach associated with the permits, and the scientific rationale. So the numbers that you see on screen are current as of a month or two ago, just over 50 permits that are either active or in the process of being renewed. Now, these numbers are usually fluctuating because some permits are crossing permits or of some other temporary nature. For example, some of the increased acreage that you see is mainly due to the acquisition of Phase 2 of the Big Bend Wildlife Area. There are another couple of permits above and beyond these that are likely this summer. Those will be on the newly acquired Simcoe unit of the Klickitat Wildlife Area. All told, there are some 11,000 animal unit months of forage allotted on a yearly basis. A goal of many of these permits is to provide for attractive big game habitat and wintering areas, and this is mainly due to livestock preference for grass and other herbaceous forages and the properties of regrowth once that occurs. Other permits, such as on the Lloyd Ranch of the Metow Wildlife Area, seek to control weeds, or on the Shillipoo and Columbia Basin Wildlife Areas, actually alter the structure of tall emergent vegetation that might otherwise impede waterfowl use. Several of our grazing permits are part of coordinated resource management plans. We also just call those CRM plans. And these are typically large landscapes that have joint ownership. So, for example, we might be fenced in common with DNR land, Forest Service land, BLM, or even private lands. And what we've found is that having a single cohesive management strategy seems to work better than having each agency work in isolation. I think these CRMs are a really important opportunity for us. Not only does it give us some regional influence on management, but it also allows us to support traditional uses of these landscapes. As we heard, these can be real considerations in several different areas of Washington. Supporting community character and the economy are part of the strategic plan as well. These considerations are important enough that they have been explicit terms of a number of recent acquisitions. A good example of that is the Simcoe unit that I just mentioned. The department has entered into a CRM process with the local conservation districts in Goldendale to ensure that everybody is on board with how that unit will be managed. And then finally, we can graze to maintain or improve ecological function. A number of our wildlife areas are not exactly subject to the same types of fire regimes, for example, that prevailed prior to statehood. There is evidence that grazing can serve as a surrogate for fire and basically function as a low-level disturbance that can help foster increased abundance and diversity of certain types of forage, annual forbs, for instance, or shrubs that are seasonally or annually important to different types of wildlife species. Whichever combination of those goals that we articulate in a permit, commission policy stipulates these types of considerations. The first is to maintain ecological integrity, which I'll define shortly. Also, it requires cross-program review, which we interpret as district team review. We've been working to improve the process, giving more time to regional program managers and district biologists to review and provide necessary comments. I have a lot of confidence in the comments that come from these staff. So not only do I have the privilege of working with Cynthia and Paul, but I get to interact with a lot of just top-notch staff around the state, and they're good at what they do. We've increased pretty dramatically the amount of information that we're collecting from these grazed landscapes, which we expect will allow us to better implement adaptive management. And then finally, policy asks for a grazing plan, and I'll go through what those entail. We've worked to standardize the format of these grazing plans while still allowing them to be tailored to each individual situation. So I promised you I'd define ecological integrity. It's a key goal of all of our department lands. While we do have species-specific measures that get implemented in certain places, we're also working to provide the best possible habitat for a broad array of species. And so as you can see up here, ecological integrity is just, it's an ecosystem's ability to maintain its structure, composition, and function under the bounds of a normal disturbance regime. So as I mentioned, we don't always have normal historical disturbance regimes, but conserving soil and trying to encourage the most desirable kinds of vegetation will ensure that these landscapes are as resistant as possible to disturbance and resilient in recovering from possibly abnormal disturbances. So these are the elements of our grazing plans. The ones that you see highlighted in yellow, I'll dive into a little bit more detail because I'll talk about the questions that you had for us. The background is just a concise statement about a wildlife area's purpose and the role of grazing there. In the resource description, we'll cover soil types, ecological sites, current climate, current vegetation, priority habitats and species, these kinds of things. After the goals and objectives, the grazing prescription will identify the specific acreage in question, as well as the intensity of grazing and the timing of grazing, and these change from permit to permit. The anticipated effects cover, that consists of an expanded literature review based on the effects on plants and wildlife. And the monitoring section will cover two types of monitoring, compliance monitoring and effectiveness monitoring, and I'll describe what those are. And a contingency section. This is where we address what might happen in the course of a grazing permit. For example, response to a wildfire, a move trigger of some certain amount of utilization, noxious weed discovery and notification, those types of considerations. So embedded within that first yellow bullet, the grazing prescription section, are some important protective conditions. The first one there you see is intensity. That's basically how much forage are we allowing to be harvested by livestock. Several authors have indicated that a conservative stocking rate is perhaps the most important and influential element of any grazing management plan. A conservative stocking rate not only conserves habitat, but it protects the agency and the operator from having to drastically destock during the dry years that frequently come. In order to get a conservative stocking rate, you have to adjust the estimated forage availability for things like unpalatable species, steep terrain, and poor access to water, all of which cattle will tend to avoid. Timing is another important consideration. Grazing rotations that feature spring grazing will usually be shorter or less frequent than grazing rotations later on in the summer. Fall grazing can sometimes be a good option for habitat, but it needs to be monitored carefully because it's typically at this time of year that cattle will tend to shift their diets from upland grasses to riparian forages, and that includes both herbaceous forages as well as woody vegetation, shrubs, cottonwood trees, that type of thing can get taken. This section will also describe specific exclusions. This might be wetlands, it might be riparian areas, research plots, etc. More protective conditions can be found in the contingencies section. So the first is utilization limits. I might have called this a move trigger before. Basically, that's a trigger for livestock to be removed from a pasture once utilization has attained some certain amount. It might be 35%, it might be 50%. Most of our permits have ceilings somewhere in that range. A lot of permits, they don't achieve that much utilization, so we're below those ceilings, but we still check those typically at least twice a year to make sure. Following wildfire, a pasture will usually be rested for 1 to 2 years, and so far up in the Okanagan, we've been able to keep pretty close eye on those to make sure that grazing can be resumed as soon as, but not before, adequate recovery of soils and vegetation has occurred. Weed management might be described in general terms. If there's a specific issue, we'll be more specific in the plan. And then consistency with ecological integrity. I'll note that in every instance in which I've been able to analyze repeat ecological integrity data on a grazing plan, that's been maintained. We would certainly seek district team input if that were not to be the case about how to proceed. The anticipated effects section describes the scientific rationale. So we'll often break this down into effects on vegetation and then direct and indirect effects on wildlife. Our grazing permits have always had some amount of cited literature, but we've tried to expand this discussion recently, add more current articles to make sure that we're reflecting up-to-date thinking. Some of the themes from the scientific literature you see here on this slide. So ungulates seem to prefer recently grazed areas in a number of locations. Some of that work has been done on the Starkey Experimental Forest in Oregon. Some has been done elsewhere. We don't always understand the mechanism. Sometimes it seems to be structural, where game just have easier access to somewhat shorter grazed vegetation. Other labs, some, not all, have found that the regrowth of previously grazed vegetation is as a higher nutritional component. Grazing, light to moderate grazing, that is usually heterogeneous, so you'll get different structural effects and different intensity effects throughout a pasture, which can lead to more edge habitat and increased vegetation diversity. I've placed a question mark at the end of fuels management because it depends on where you're at. There's evidence, pretty good evidence, that grazing will strongly influence fire behavior in grassland environments. The literature suggests that that effect tends to decrease the more shrubs and the more trees that you have in a system. Having said that, I'll note that the Forest Service, when conducting a prescribed burn, will usually rest a pasture for at least a year prior to that burn to increase its ability to carry a fire. I think there is a role for fuels management and grazing on department lands, but we would be very careful about using that as a primary justification. We've talked a little bit about annual forbs and shrubs benefiting in the presence of livestock grazing. I just want to end this slide by noting that there's actually a lot of evidence that wildlife habitat can be maintained simultaneously with light to moderate livestock grazing. So that includes big game, it includes pasture and birds. Upland ground nesting birds, the picture is a little bit muddier. There's been an awful lot of resources within the last few years devoted to understanding the indirect and now the direct influence of livestock on things like sage grouse and sharp-tailed grouse. While we're implementing current recommendations on department lands that are in sagegrass areas, we would certainly seek to understand anything new that comes out of all this work that's being done and implemented there as well. I want to talk about the two types of monitoring that we do, compliance and effectiveness. So for compliance monitoring, we'll be tracking progress toward objectives, and we'll also be doing utilization monitoring. This is we'll either do height-weight monitoring or landscape appearance. These are both standard federal procedures. That plot there is a little bit hard to see, but what it shows is a regression between the amount of vegetation height that's removed and the amount of biomass that's removed, which is our main concern. So what you can see there is that when 50% of the vegetation height is removed, that's the horizontal axis, that corresponds to 20% of the vegetation biomass removed, that's on the vertical axis. And what that means is when you look at a move trigger of 50% weight removed, that's almost 75% of vegetation height. And I bring that up because removing between 20 and 50% of the vegetation height, or 50 and 75%, you're going to notice that. It's going to look grazed. The landscape should not look cowed up, or as a rancher might say, slicked off, but it's going to look grazed. And our point is that even in that grazed appearance, that landscape is still going to support a broad array of habitat values. So the other type of monitoring is effectiveness. We'll sometimes refer to this as a long-term monitoring or ecological integrity monitoring, and it's less frequent because it's looking at the vegetation composition. We're also looking at a number of soil variables. So there's vegetation cover, gap, frequency. This is very comparable to BLM's AIM monitoring protocol. We can institute species-specific measures if we're particularly concerned about one wildlife species here. This is the situation on uplands. In riparian areas, we're using the multiple indicator monitoring method. This is also a federal protocol. It's especially used in areas that have been affected by grazing-related litigation. So that would be places like the Challis National Forest in Idaho and the Malheur National Forest down in Oregon. I should note that we don't actually have very much riparian area in our grazing permits. It's usually excluded, not included. In places where we do, this is what we're doing, and that would include the Tiehnawi Community Forest as well. It's important to realize there are things that we are not monitoring. Some of those things include forage characteristics, so shrub leader growth, palatability, nutrient content. Those take a lot of samples. They're expensive. I don't think the department would stand to gain very much by redoing these types of analyses. We're not looking at wildlife populations or behaviors or diets. Again, that's been done. Community character and economy, we're not looking closely at those, not because they're unimportant, but because most of us in the department are biologists, and we're not set up to address those types of questions. Replication questions. We have been experimenting with the optimal number of sample plots. We'll probably continue to do that. In the meantime, we're looking at federal guidance that exists as well. So I've mentioned federal protocols in a number of cases. I think most of us realize that the Forest Service and the BLM often have a hard time performing all the monitoring that they would like to do or that they're supposed to do. But the actual procedures themselves are tested and they're rigorous. A lot of the best current range science is either federally funded or federally published or both. And so we're citing those documents to answer these types of questions. We're also citing other scientific literature and WDFW planning documents. So all this information should allow us to better learn from management outcomes and to adjust accordingly. So adaptive management is not a prescribed action in response to some specific occurrence. For example, a move trigger. That's not adaptive management. That's just something we do if a certain condition is met. Adaptive management is not especially quick. It's usually not going to be especially cheap. But it's probably the best way to understand why certain things are happening and the best way to address them. So there are a couple of things that we're doing to make adaptive management success more likely. One is to always reserve the right to change the terms of a permit if necessary. We don't often invoke this, but we do exercise it. We're also reporting the results of monitoring. So a lot of older grazing permits don't really talk about the effect of grazing on the wildlife area in some previous iteration of that permit. What we're doing now is we're reporting the results of monitoring in each successive permit, as well as including photographic data from standard photo points. And our hope is that these will allow the district team and everyone else, actually, to better understand what is happening on those pastures and what is not happening. So we've talked about monitoring, we've talked about adaptive management, scientific rationale, and protective conditions. So I'll close with this final slide, outreach. We've talked about district team review. There are several types of external outreach that we've been participating in as well. Maybe the most important of these is coordinated resource management processes. A lot of these are in Okanagan County, but we also have some in Kittitas and Klickitat counties. Another venue for us are a couple of events staged annually by the Washington Cattlemen's Association. That is, of course, an advocacy group, and they have their own agenda. But they do two events which are productive. One of those is a field day every summer where they tour a public lands grazing operation and talk about relevant issues. And another one is a public lands forum that they stage every fall. They invite staff from Fish and Wildlife, Natural Resources, the Forest Service, and talk about things that are of particularly current interest. I'd imagine that we'd continue to attend those. Paul mentioned the wildlife area planning process earlier. A number of wildlife areas have grazing. We bring this up during the planning process, and it usually garners a number of comments spanning a wide spectrum of opinion. There are other one-time events. A couple of years ago, we presented the results of pilot grazing in the form of a webinar. Last spring, we teamed up with NRCS to stage a monitoring workshop in connection with the Sagegrass Initiative. We look for these types of things. I think they're really important, and I will continue to do those. So I thank you for your attention. Can we address any questions?
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Jeff. Very informative. Questions? Yes.
Well, to Cynthia as well, and Paul and Jeff, I'd really like to thank you for both presentations. Very, very informative. And also to acknowledge the addition of foresters and range biologists to the program, I think, has been just a great addition. I've really enjoyed listening to you, Jeff, as you've talked. I think you bring a level of professionalism to range biology that's doing the department proud. You've heard some of my concerns, but I'm going to repeat them for the group. As in terms of monitoring, well, to back up a little bit, I think this presentation comes to us because of a stakeholder who has raised concerns about the compatibility of managing for wildlife and grazing, and the fact that our mission first talks about wildlife conservation, fish and wildlife conservation. And the monitoring concerns mostly looking at the vegetation. You had the list of things that you monitor. And thank you for highlighting upland species. As you know, that's my area of real interest. I've been quite astonished at how complex this can really be, and I'll just highlight a paper that I heard about a year ago by an entomologist at a sage grouse and sharptail grouse workshop. And he had a couple of plots grazed and ungrazed, and he was looking at insect species. And both in terms of quantity and what insects were there. The interesting sort of summary of the results was there were more insects in the grazed land, but the insects that he found in the ungrazed land were actually higher quality forage for sage grouse. They like beetles better than they like grasshoppers, was kind of the summary as I remember it. So to me, that really highlighted how complex it is to understand the impact of grazing on wildlife species. And I just throw that out and see if you would like to make a comment on it.
So I think you bring up a good point. I was talking to Paul Wick, who's our district wildlife biologist down in the Blue Mountains the other day, and he mentioned that we really don't have a good idea of the effects of some of our management decisions on things like insect populations and bumblebee populations. It would be really useful to have that kind of information, and maybe we'll reach a point where we're able to get those and understand them better than we are now.
Thank you. Any other questions? Good. Well, thanks, guys. Thanks, Cindy. Is the archaeologist based in Olympia, by the way?
Yes. Yes. Catherine Kelly is.
Okay.
Yeah, she's based in Olympia.
Oh.
She's out around the state a lot.
Yeah. Huh. And that's a new hire, you said, last year?
2 years ago.
Two years ago?
No, just 3 years.
Thank you.